Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of 342 Productions. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me, as always, is my co-host, Steve Jones Jr. Steve, how are you doing, sir?
Ready to deliver some analysis like no one else can.
All right. Let's get after it then. Fun slate of hoops this week. Good gracious, did we have a lot of games on Thursday, but we're going to leave those alone for now, as we did have the NBA Cup Finals on Tuesday. The Milwaukee Bucks, as Steve predicted, able to knock off the Oklahoma City Thunder 97-81 in that one, in a game where defense reigned. A lot of shots were missed, just broadly speaking, but through the lens of what Milwaukee was able to do, their defense showed up once again. I think Andre Jackson Jr. at the point of attack did a really good job against Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. Torian Prince did his best against Jalen Williams when he got that matchup. A lot of rejects for Jalen. He did his job, funneling him inside, and ultimately the size of Milwaukee in the front court popped over and over and over again. And this one, at least for me, Brooke Lopez, major presence at the rim, Giannis, major presence at the rim. And watching the lack of respect is probably too strong. That's the lack of care that Milwaukee showed some of OKC's shooters in the half court was interesting to me. It was something that I was curious about heading into this matchup. It was going to be a big role player game for OKC if they're going to be able to get this done. I don't think anyone anticipated OKC going 5 of 32 for 3. Like, that was very much outlier bad for them. But it did seem like Milwaukee, I guess, doubled down on the template of let's flood the paint. Let's make sure Jalen Williams, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander aren't comfortable when they do get downhill. And we're going to dare these other guys to beat us. We're going to have that extra layer of help inside from Giannis when he's roaming off of Lu Dort or Alex Caruso whenever he had that matchup. Brooke Lopez, again, naturally had Isaiah Hartenstein. If Hartenstein was spaced anywhere, he was in the paint. And when he was lurking around the short corner, Brooke was still in the paint or flowing to the paint once those drives hit. And again, you don't bank on outlier bad shooting for OKC, but it was a strong game plan for Milwaukee. And I appreciated how they were able to attack early. We saw a lot of early, like, Giannis-Brooke pick and rolls in this one, but a lot of early transition attacks for Giannis. When OKC tried to send two towards Giannis, the ball movement was stellar, able to generate a lot of open looks from there. I was just really impressed with how Milwaukee set the tone, mostly defensively. The second half really got hazy for OKC, but I appreciate the defense overall in this one, but I really want to start with what Milwaukee was able to do defensively against OKC.
I think what Milwaukee did was they gave the effort. You know, I don't think it was a perfect world for the Bucks on defense at all, but that effort was consistent throughout the whole game. They gave multiple efforts. They worked to fly around. They worked to help and recover. They tried to contain as many drives as they could. They really worked to get OKC in some late clock scenarios and situations and try and bog down the tempo a little bit. I thought they were very solid on guard screens, which is something that's good, mixing in switches and also understanding when OKC is not really setting one and not overcommitting, not putting two on the ball, not falling for the slip. The little things they did in transition to show multiple bodies. I think the amount of bodies that Oklahoma City consistently saw in the paint during that game, the rotations from Giannis, I think they nailed every note they needed to on defense. Now, yeah, I think the interesting part, as you mentioned, hey, a lack of care for Oklahoma City shooters. And I'm sure we'll tap into the Oklahoma City portion of it here in a little bit. I don't think it's as much a lack of care for Oklahoma City shooters as more so this is the poison we're going to take. This is how you're going to have to beat us. And this is kind of something that's more of a playoff-ish type game plan to where, okay, you kind of have to solve this very specific problem right now. So Oklahoma City had good success early on putting Dame in action. They were putting Brooke in action and getting success in the drop via pull-up or Hartenstein floaters. Now Milwaukee, as the game progresses, mixes in more late switches, more switches. You know, one of my favorite moves this year has been Brooke Lopez. I get a switch. You decide you're about to try and cook me. I just spin move towards the paint and try and meet you at the rim. And Milwaukee was just able to do it over and over again. Now, OKC didn't make the shots to make Milwaukee pay. OKC generated the shots to make Milwaukee pay. And that's where kind of the blend comes in. But I think it's more of a credit to me to Milwaukee in what they've done, because I don't know if they would have had this kind of effort and this kind of base and this kind of consistency as a team defensively earlier in the season or even last year. And so that's kind of where I want to tip my cap to them And I want to tip my cap to what they've done on the other end as well. I mean, you talked about Brooks setting high screens for Giannis, terrifying aspect right there. Just comes downhill like a wrecking ball. And when Brooks sets it flat near half court, Giannis can just go either way. And so you mix in his improved passing, which I'm not sure gets highlighted enough to where it's just automatic. If you were going to show help, he's going to find the open person. And that helps Milwaukee so much. Milwaukee being able to use Damian Lillard and Giannis in a wave together offensively has always been really good stuff. So it's not just empty corner action. It's not just two-man game pick and roll. It's an action for Giannis into an action for Dame, and you got to handle both of them in different ways. Mm-hmm. But Giannis, the ways they're kind of mixing him around, putting him in different spots, getting him the ball at the elbow, finding ways to force help, mid-range jumpers he's hitting. Now you got to deal with Giannis in the post. Like, there's an assortment there with Giannis's game that I think has been fun to watch.
Yeah, I think that's really good stuff there. Like, I think to your point about moving Giannis around, like, it felt even more like an issue against OKC. Like, naturally, Giannis is the number one option there. But with the way that OKC loves showing help, but we will also send doubles. If you're moving Giannis all around the chessboard and you're also moving Dame around the chessboard at the same time, it does become more difficult to just take away things and funnel Dupal to specific spots. It didn't feel like OKC was able to tap that button quite enough to where they could kind of dictate what Milwaukee did offensively. To your point, again, then to your point, like, that is a testament to the Milwaukee game plan, how well Giannis played, how well Dame played in that one, knock down five threes, make some crucial shots in crucial spots. I think it was really good stuff for Milwaukee in the half court as well. I think going back to OKC and the offense slash Milwaukee's defense, only 46 drives logged for OKC in this game, which if the game counted towards the regular season standings, et cetera, that would be tied for the season low. On any trip featuring an OKC drive per second spectrum, 0.49 points per possession, which would easily be one of the worst marks in a game this season, period. It was OKC's worst effort of the season. Their previous low was 0.79 points per possession against the Lakers in late November. There were some shots at the rim that were missed that are just normal makes. Like, I think Jalen Williams, as much as I appreciate the effort from Torian Prince when he got the matchup, it was a lot of high pick and roll. I'm going to reject. I'm going to slither inside. And like some of the floaters or some of the short pull-ups that Jalen Williams has been knocking down at a high level this year, which is why he's, if he's not an all-star, he's certainly close this year. Some of those shots just didn't fall. Like, I do think, again, like OKC got some poor shooting luck in some aspects. But the commitment, as you mentioned, for Milwaukee, no, you're going to see bodies. Regardless of what the initial coverage ends up being, you're going to see bodies. You're going to have to adjust your shots. You're going to have to knock these down. And if you hit enough, then we'll do something else. I appreciated that level of consistency from Milwaukee. But seeing the drive number be as low as it was, like, I think some of that is a testament to some of the initial defense that we saw, some of the initial screen navigation that we saw. But also, they're seeing the bodies early. Like, OKC mixed in some higher ball screens or some higher handoffs or just some early transition attacks. And you will see Brook Lopez, if he's supposed to be defending Isaiah Hartenstein or insert non-shooter here, if he's just matching up with someone random, he's flowing to the paint early. Giannis flowing to the paint early. And so even if you wanted to get all the way downhill, you're already seeing that amount of size basically beating you to your spot before you can even get into your drive all the way. I think that helped influence some of the decisions that we saw with the ball in their hands. And again, very reductive, but if the jumper's all falling and you also don't feel comfortable getting all the way to the rim, and when you do get there, you're getting tough challenges from Giannis or Brook and some from Bobby Portis. We'll give him a quick hat tip there. Or you're just missing some of the shots you normally make. You do just kind of run out of options. Like, OKC did get to the line a little bit, but it certainly wasn't enough to counteract the lack of shooting success that they had in this one. And ultimately, I mentioned the overall OKC drive stat. How many drives do you think Shea logged in this game?
13.
10 drives from Shea Gilgeous-Alexander, like, that's a first quarter number for him. And that was a full game stat per second spectrum. Like, it was genuinely absurd. And again, gave the hat tip early. But Andre Jackson Jr. really did a good job on Shea in this game. And you layer that with, again, the presence at the rim, it just got kind of tough. And I think, thinking about OKC broadly, this isn't something that they haven't seen before. To your point, picking the poison, we're going to flood the paint. We're going to dare you to knock down these shots out here. I don't think that's going to change because they are so good at getting in the paint and making things happen. I think that's just going to be the natural thing that teams try to take away. Are you worried about that at all long term for OKC?
Worry is a strong word. I mean, but I think over the course of a regular season, there are moments where teams have to figure out things, solve things, and evolve. And I think one of the things we forget about this Oklahoma City team, one, they're very good. Two, they make shots that look different. Three, they're trying to evolve and elevate their formula. You know, this team is a little bit different. You mentioned the low drives per game. I don't think this team is as drive and kicky as they were last year, if that makes sense. Yeah. They're not as reliant on that. Part of that is the roster is a little bit different. Another part of that is, hey, let's make our base stronger so we have more things to do. They're a really good basketball team on both ends of the floor. We know what they do with drive and kick. We know what they do with guard-guard screens. You add Hartenstein, especially with Chet out, that means a little bit more pick and roll play, which is a good addition. Something else we can run. Shea and Hartenstein, their chemistry has evolved. Hartenstein's ability to score on the short roll and make decisions gives them a different layer. He can spray it out. Now you get another advantage a different way. You get some more hub work from Hartenstein, whether at the elbow or playing through him at the top. Unlocks the cutting. That's a different way for Oklahoma City to get you in rotation. Unlocks a different part of their offense. The thing is now you got to kind of balance it out playbook-wise. And so the movement and cutting looks really good when it's popping. But you have a possession where Andre Jackson Jr. is denying Shea. Now you're going to a dribble handoff with Isaiah Joe or Cason Wallace. And so you talk about, hey, defenses don't necessarily care to a degree. It's less that. It's more, I could slide under this. Your counter is a rescreen if I go under. Okay, now we're right back in our base drop. I'm either going to navigate and get back in front, or the big's going to do a late switch, and now you don't have the same advantage. So you run decent things, but you're not generating the same advantage that we've seen from an OKC team where drive kick, drive kick, drive kick, constantly in rotation, you're constantly reacting. That's something they have to adjust to. Mm-hmm. If it's Jalen Williams and you look up and everything he's done is in transition or pick and roll, okay, where's his secondary drives? Are the secondary drives just going to be the responsibility of the Carusos, the Cambridge Williams, the Joes, the Wallaces? How does that shift things? How many times does the ball swing back to their top players? Now it's, oh, no, we have to rotate back to them. I think for Oklahoma City, they have to understand the type of shots that they can generate consistently. I think that was probably some of the balance issue in the third quarter. Again, they missed a bunch of shots. And the key to me is, would you rather be a team that is missing shots but can consistently generate them, or a team that's trying to figure out how to generate quality open looks? And I thought the Thunder did really get some good shots in this one. I also thought they took some quick ones, whether it was off offensive rebounds, off a swing, some contested ones. You know, that's where they're going to have to kind of figure out, okay, what's the optimal shot diet for us to a degree? They're in this in-between zone of being aggressive and decisive once you get a team in rotation, because we've seen the best of drive and kick from them, and we've also seen that lead to them passing up shots. So now you see them a little bit more quicker on the trigger at times to let it fly. And you have the Dallas game, the one where they got beat, then the one where they won, as an example of what can happen and what can shift. And then you get to a point where the shots aren't falling, and you have this Milwaukee game. So to me, it's not as much a concern about Oklahoma City, period. I think if they can balance things out, they can get to a point where they understand, okay, on these nights where the shots aren't falling, this can't just become a jump shooting contest. This is where we're going to have to figure out what can we get to help us during these stretches so now we can get back to business. And that's part of being a good team overall. I think the worry becomes less about OKC and more about the league. As this league works and evolves, teams try to figure out ways to poke at you. If you have enough success, they're going to figure out ways to poke at you. And to your Milwaukee's game plan point, especially as the season tightens up, we get to the playoffs. Okay, we're going to live with this. We're going to live with this. If this beats us, it beats us. Or if you do it enough and we have to adjust, we adjust then. But until that point, this is what we're going to do. Does OKC arrive at that point? Do more teams now decide to throw this at them? Is this not something you only see against the Dallases of the worlds or the Milwaukees of the worlds? Because not every team can nail it. You know, it takes effort. It's why OKC is hard to guard. But we've seen it year after year. A team pokes at something. Maybe they don't have the success. Maybe they don't have enough. Maybe they don't have a win. But another team sees it and tries it. says, hey, we can do that. We can do that better. Why don't we just do this? So now it becomes a scenario at times. And, you know, this is a hypothetical, but you can get put into a box as a team where now you're just having to solve this one problem or play this one type of way a lot more than what you would want. You know, like I don't have concerns about the Boston Celtics, but if teams just decide we're going to do this, they go the Memphis route and say, hey, our big's on Drew, deal with it. Or, hey, we're fine switching, deal with it. And now you have to do that over and over and over again before you get to the playoffs. Things can get tricky. Now, again, no concern with Boston. I think they're really good. But how many teams are going to be willing to try it is probably where I'm at.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. Like, I think broader strokes, as you said, that, like, it kind of reminds me of, don't want to misattribute to, like, Philly was the first team to ever do the four on Jokic, let the big man roam type thing. But it reminds me of Philly having success with that and saying, hey, PJ, you do your best against Jokic.
This is Utah Jazz erasure.
See, this is why I was like, hey, I don't want to, this is why I didn't want to misattribute. But, like, that's what came to mind. It's like, hey, Philly did this, and now here's Minnesota. Like, well, hey, Kat, you do your best against Jokic. We're going to have Rudy Gobert roam. So just the idea of team does it, hey, we can try this. We might have better personnel. We might have more size, et cetera, et cetera. And I also think just broader strokes with OKC, like it's good for them to get this test. And with this cup run in particular, hey, we see Dallas again, and they gave us some issues in the postseason. We didn't play Houston. Slightly different personnel. Could be a little switchier, a little bit more athletic. Not quite the size element that Dallas has. Elite defense, though. We get through that. And though the offense didn't necessarily hum in that game either, but we get through that. And now we get Milwaukee, which certainly not as switchy as a Houston, has a little bit more size than Dallas. Showed that early help, kind of Dallas-esque. And you lose this one. 5-32 from three. Again, ridiculous. I think it is. It's interesting to balance, like, hey, more teams might try this versus if they continue to get reps against this and then they do solve it. I do wonder where defenses go next and what the evolution of trying to put OKC in a box is. I think that's where the intrigue lies. And so the fact that we have seen like varying success levels with OKC in these cup games, I think is intriguing. I think it's going to be important with the journey. Like it just makes me think about Mark Dadnall's been pretty consistent about we're not trying to rush this growing process. Obviously they want to win, but you know, among all the chatter last year, hey, make a trade. This team's really good. Make a trade, get a big, et cetera, et cetera. It's like, no, we are doing good things. We are young and early in this. Let's see how far this iteration can go. Let's see what we need. And now we can make pivots. And I think it's kind of a similar element here where, okay, defenses are going to try to do this. We're not going to shoot 5 of 32 from three every night. We're not going to get a 10 drive Shea game every night. We've had success against this particular style already early in the cup. Like, I don't want to overreact to this. Like, I think it could just be a fun, like, stepping stone for them moving forward. I think this could be an important experience and important reps overall for them with this.
No, this is the fun of the regular season. This is where you get to understand what makes a team good, where a team's going to try and poke at them, how do they overcome that, and you get a complete product, you get a complete journey of a team, you have that understanding. If I were to go back in time and tell you Milwaukee was going to do this defensively over these last couple of games, probably would be a quick conversation, right? But that's the work that they've put in. And so, you know, it doesn't have to be an indictment. You can see, hey, maybe this is a bad thing. But as you said, if they were able to overcome it, now you got to come up with something different. And they've put the work in to layer the offense in a way that, all right, we figure this out. We also have this going. We also have this going. We also have this going. So now we're more of a complete package. So, but I mean, salute to Milwaukee, because again, we talk about counters. I thought OKC tried to hit their counters. All right, switch, we attack, you help, cut. There's more people in the paint. So we're missing shots. It's basketball.
Yeah. It's basketball indeed. And I think with Milwaukee in general, like what a run this has been for pretty much the last month at this point. As they have climbed the standings, Darvin Ham, once again, he just does not lose cup games. Just quick salute to Darvin Ham.
Salute.
Gosh, that I walked right into that one. But no, like they are really building out momentum here. And I think the wave of Giannis and Dame And with Giannis in particular, he has been so freaking good on both ends of the floor. Him taking the challenges on some of these switches, the rim protection that he's brought, obviously the rebounding and the grab-and-go threat that he is, the early transition drives, just the static drives, the mid-range jumpers, which, again, the Commissioner's Cup, the NBA Cup championship game didn't count towards the standings, but 10 of 19 on twos overall in this game. And just thinking about the mid-range shooting, on Basketball Reference, on shots between 10 and 16 feet for Giannis this year, he's converting 53.8% of those. That is easily a career high. He was at 32.3 last year. As we've had plenty of conversations on here in the watch parties about like the timeliness of some of the Giannis jumpers, like kind of maybe like, hey, you didn't have to take that one, et cetera. You have been consistent in saying like, hey, this is fine. It's one of those, if I have this going, what else are you going to do type beats? It's a counter for him. If he's knocking down over 50% of those shots, when you try to build up this wall in the half court, and he could just sprinkle in enough of those relief jumpers, and then you get right back into the drives, the post-ups, being used as a screener, being used as a handoff guy, and the way that they are layering things around him. Again, like just the simple construct of Dame one pass away, didn't have Chris Middleton in this game, but in general, Dame one pass away, Chris Middleton two passes away. AJ Green, if he's making the entry pass, I've enjoyed the evolution of AJ Green just filling the Pat Connaughton role of I'll just screen and die for Giannis all the time. But if AJ Green's one pass away, or if AJ Green's in the opposite corner, because of the growth, as you mentioned, of Giannis's passing, if you do send a double, Giannis is a good enough passer and he's ultimately just big enough to see over the top, he could just skip steps, figuratively and literally. Okay, I can just swing this to the opposite wing. That's one swing pass to the corner. That's AJ Green getting an open one. Like, they've just done a really good job of building the boat around what Giannis does. Giannis has also just played better. Passing's upgraded. The drives continue to be super effective. And defensively, the possession-by-possession effort has been so much better than it was earlier in the season. He's been on an incredible run. And capping this cup run with a triple-double just seems fitting for what he's been doing during this stretch. Giannis is a darn monster, bro.
I mean, during the cup, he averaged 30, 10, and 7, shooting 66% from the field.
That seems pretty good.
I mean, last year, we averaged 30 on 61% shooting, first player to do that. This year, he's averaging 32 on 61% shooting.
That also seems pretty good.
No, I'll add, Giannis is doing what he needs to do defensively for this team to be where they want to go. And I think that was probably some of the elements that were missing over the last year or so. But, you know, kudos to him, kudos to Dame for, you know, the growth they've had, the understanding they've had, the drives that he's had, him being able to pick his spots in different ways. So, I mean, I think they're moving and grooving. I think you see way more possessions where the ball is flowing after the first action than you had before. So, that's what you want. That's the vision. We'll see where it takes them. But they did what they had to do, put themselves in a spot, and now it's go time.
That it is. Just close things out with some base numbers here. Giannis in the title game, 26 points, 19 rebounds, 10 assists, 2 steals, and 3 blocks. Just normal day at the office for Giannis Antetokounmpo. 23-4-4 for Dame, 13-9 for Brooke Lopez. Also had a steal and a block. 21 points for Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, but 6 of 15 inside the arc, 2 of 9 from 3. Isaiah Hartenstein with 12, 14, and 4, a steal and a block. Steve, as you mentioned, had some of those early possessions in pick and roll, getting some of those floaters. Also, just like the flashes from him. Hey, we're in trouble in the middle of the clock or later in the clock. Let me just get to the free throw line. Doesn't have to be me being directly involved in action, just finding pockets of space and getting buckets. Important counter for OKC to have in the half court, but 12 and 14 for Hartenstein, 18 points for Jalen Williams, but 7 of 16 inside the arc, only 1 of 4 from 3 in this one. Again, this was very much a low scoring affair. Gave you the total score earlier, but per cleaning the glass, which excludes the last 243 with garbage time, but a 101.1 offensive rating for Milwaukee in this one, very low. It was just an 84.6 for OKC. An 86.5 offensive rating to half court for Milwaukee. Very low, but again, good process stuff there. A 67.9 for OKC. And then just quickly on the pick and roll front, as you mentioned, Steve, some of the drives maybe being substituted with more pick and roll action. with the addition of Hartenstein. 36 pick and rolls for Shea in this one, 19 for Jalen Williams, around 0.6 point possession for both of those guys. And on the Giannis front, 26 pick and rolls would be a season high for him, and 15 between him and Brooke, which would also be a season high if those stats counted towards regular season numbers. So wanted to cap it there. Any closing cup thoughts on this game or just the concept in general?
Cup is fun. Competitive basketball. Take advantage of the early season. And now you keep moving. Salute to the Emirates NBA Cup all-tournament team, led by Giannis Antetokounmpo. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander was also there. Damian Lillard, Trae Young, and Alperen Şengün. Others receiving votes. Isaiah Hartenstein missed out by one. He got five. Şengün got six. Franz Wagner also got five. Jalen Johnson with four. Jalen Williams with three. And then Steph Curry, Luka, De'Aaron Fox, Nikola Jokic, Brook, and Kat with one. So there you go.
There we go. Well, appreciate that. Appreciate that. I'm with you. I enjoyed it. I thought the games, or especially the knockout round games, like they were just really good basketball games. Like the score deficit in this one was obviously not as close as you would want it to be, but even that really just turned late third, early fourth. And it was a lot of good defense. Like you had your eye tuned towards it. Like that's some top tier hoop for me. But either way, quality run for the Thunder. Sure, they hate that it ended like this, and a quality run overall for the Milwaukee Bucks, who continue and hope to continue to ride out their momentum. And with that, we can now transition into the mailbag. Thank you to those who have sent in and continue to send in questions. Again, you don't need a prompt if you have basketball thoughts at any time. Email us at dunkerspot@yahoo.com. That is dunkerspot@yahoo.com. Our first one going to come from Maya or Mia. You can correct me in the email if necessary. But question states, there seems to be this thing with fans where they seem to think in any given year, there are 5 to 6 contenders. Been a basketball fan my whole life. In any given year, there are only 2 or 3 on a great year 4, and they're pretty obvious coming into the year. Which do you think is closer to the truth?
I may specifically and literally be the worst person on the planet to ask this question, have it be answered, but I'm going to give it a go and try my best and try and do it without ranting and raving about how people view the regular season and how we run through teams and praise them and tear them down and everything being tied to reads and all that jazz. No, I'm going to try not to do it.
Okay.
For me, I guess part of it depends on your definition of a contender. So if you're going to walk into a season and say, who do I think is going to win the championship? That list probably is low to a degree, especially preseason. We haven't seen anything. So, you know, if you're walking in preseason, you probably just like, Celtics definitely, and like pick a West team, Suns, and then you probably can just walk away and move forward and, you know, sim to playoffs if you would like. To me, knowing how hard it is to make a run to the conference finals, I think you're a contender in my book if you do that or have the ability to do that, because if you do that, you're 4 wins away from competing for the actual championship. So that to me tells me that you have a shot at this, which some maybe I have a lower bar, but I digress. I think historically there have been plenty of times where that's true. This is this team's league. Maybe Team X in the East could do it. Maybe Team West and the Y could beat them, but this is their league, and we go from there. I don't know if we're living in those times right now. I like the regular season too much to just start with 2 teams and then add as I go on. I probably do the reverse. You know, I like trying to understand what makes a team good, what makes them bad, what have they worked through during the season, what position have they put themselves in, what is their path to win. You know, we've had in the history of just this podcast, teams that we felt were pretty strong. Like I think it was a year 1, the Lakers, pretty good trying to defend their title. Unfortunately, they ended up facing what, Phoenix in the first round? Yeah, so. It's kind of hard for you to, it's a hard path for you to make it work. And there are teams where, okay, maybe they don't have the pedigree of some of the other teams around them, but hey, if they are able to win this first round matchup, it gets a little bit lighter for them. Maybe they can make a run. So that's where my mind goes. So I probably go in reverse. I'm thinking about a block of teams as time goes on. Some teams improve, some teams get worse. Standings are what they are. You can see it's going to be tougher for certain teams. You kind of adjust as you go. I think there's just too much parity these days and too much fun in understanding who these teams are and then seeing the playoff run. Like last year, what was it? It was the number one seed and the number six seed in the Eastern Conference Finals. And the West was the number three seed against the number five seed. You don't get as much joy from Dallas, Minnesota if you don't see Dallas's growth throughout the year and if you didn't understand Minnesota's potential based on what their defense did.
Yeah.
So were they truly ever stamped as contenders? Probably not by most. But you look up and, oh my God, Minnesota's beat Denver. How? Well, yeah. The defense sure is pretty good. Anthony Edwards has nailed the playmaking and the scoring. They are now at the max of their formula. Yeah, they're there. So I think for me in my brain, if I could see what your formula is and I could see how you could get there, I'll probably put you in that list. Mm-hmm. Like it was 2 years ago, Miami made it to the finals off the play-in. The Lakers made it to the conference finals off the play-in. Were those stamped as contenders? Lakers probably at some point, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, 3 years ago, it was the top two teams in the East, and then it was West was 3-4. 4 years ago, there were only two teams with 50 or more wins. They were the Utah Jazz and the Phoenix Suns. Go back in time and see how those teams were spoken about.
Yeah, especially Utah.
So, I mean, it's a give and take. I bring it back to this year. And using that logic, how many teams are we cutting off? Or is it just Boston, OKC? Does Cleveland get the SWAT? Does Dallas get elevated? Like, is that it? Is that the list? That seems boring to me. Doesn't seem ideal. Doesn't seem much fun. I just think sometimes we write some of these teams off a little quick. I mean, the Western Conference is a monster. Honestly, how many teams would it surprise you if they made a run to the Western Conference Finals?
How many teams would surprise me that are just currently in the playoff picture, I would assume?
Well, yeah, I would assume if the Portland Trailblazers made a run to the conference finals, you'd be shocked.
just a little bit. Surprise would probably be...
There's one team you're going to say. I know the exact team you're going to say.
They humor me. Which team is it?
The Minnesota Timberwolves.
No, but I was looking in the play-in picture. That's like I think it comes from like that block of where the surprise would be, and even then, like
you mean the Lakers, Suns, and Warriors?
well, here's the thing: if the Suns are just going to be a revolving door of KD's back, oh no, Book's here, oh no, KD, hey, they're both here, oh no, Beal, that gets tough. The Warriors, Well, hey, we will see where the offense ultimately lands and who starts.
Not in Memphis, I'll tell you that much.
Good gracious. Minnesota, I am sure you have seen or heard the Anthony Edwards post game.
What did he say?
From last night where the offense ain't got bleep. We don't have an identity right now. Paraphrasing right now. Teams know I'm going to take a bunch of shots. You going to take a bunch of shots and then whatever else. And hey, anytime I drive, like there are just 3-4 bodies here, so I ain't got nothing for y'all for the people that want me to get to the rim more. Like, oh. I'm like, okay. That seems great, as the Wolves have kind of been, Roland's probably too strong, but like they have been playing better as of late, off the strength of the defense, which I guess adds to this contest. But yeah, so that's happening. And then naturally, the Lakers do have LeBron and AD, but. You know, which versions, how healthy are they going to be? Defense, right? Like, there are questions. I guess the plan in general is probably where the most questions. To your general point, though, I think all of them still do just have a path. Defense plus Steph, shot making a good enough defense in Phoenix. We just saw Minnesota in the conference finals. And you got Bron and AD. If you defend well enough and knock down enough shots, like, you could, they still have a collective level of size. So, yeah.
Eesh. And now let's bring it full circle before you go.
Okay.
Let's say those three teams all end up in the play-in, all four, let's say. Mm-hmm. Keep in mind the Warriors are only up a half a game in their position on the San Antonio Spurs.
Mm-hmm.
So now you're going to end up, folks, pals, friends, Big M who sent the question in. You're going to end up with the irony of those teams you might have thought of as contenders or wrote off early because you kept a list of 2 to 3. falling down the standings and facing the teams that rose up that you also didn't consider to be contenders because they weren't in your mind at the start of the season. The Rockets, the Grizzlies. And now we end up with chaos because 4.5 games separates the second best team in the West from watching the play-in with all of us.
You mentioned the Spurs at 11. Number 12 is the Sacramento Kings, who are a whopping 2 games out of the play-in. Like, it's nasty. I think to give my answer, like, I think on a basic level, I'm probably closer to, like, I'm probably closer to the 2 or 3 versus the 5 or 6, just on a base, on a general year. But to your point, Steve, like, there is a lot more parity. And the early question I had is, like, I wonder how much of this thinking is influenced by, you know, big three Celtics into big three Heat into Cavs Warriors. And, like, how much that block of time, it's like those 8 years or whatever, like, how much that influences, like, okay, well, it's going to be one of these two. Maybe the Spurs, or maybe the Thunder, or maybe the, like, Celtics to beat the Cavs or the Heat or whatever, whichever year you're talking about. And so I wonder how much of that influences where we're at right now. Because I think we are, especially just looking at the last 3, 4, maybe 5 years, one, there's just a lot of good teams. And with that, there are a lot of teams that have pathways. Like, as we've had our conversations throughout the history of the pod, I've certainly been more willing to acknowledge, okay, this team does have a path, even if I don't believe in it. Because early on, it's very much like, I just believe in this and I hear you, but, like, this is what I think. So I appreciate you for that. Opened my mind a little bit more on that front. And with that context, I made the comment on Redacted site, like, I think Dallas is the 3rd best team in the league right now. And even with that, like, are they, you know, if Dallas is a 95, do I think the 4th best team is like an 87? Like, no. Like, there are a lot of good teams. Like, we've talked about Memphis. Like, they've been top 10 or top 5 in offense and defense pretty much all year long. If they are actually able to string together a month straight of good health between their top 3 or top 4, at the very least, they're not going to be scared to play anybody in a postseason setting. And you have a game breaker in Ja who can just toss your defense over the top rope in a playoff setting. So, like, that gets fun. Like, I have the Houston offense questions for sure. But, Lord, all they need is 2 weeks of good shooting when they have that kind of foundation defensively. Wouldn't surprise me. Like, they profile as a team that, at the very least, they can defend just about anyone in a playoff setting. They just got to make shots late. You know how I feel about OKC. The Clippers just quietly the 5 seed right now. And Kawhi's practicing now. And so if their defense holds, you have the playmaking and shot creation of James Harden, you get Kawhi back into the fold. That's a formula. That's a path. Denver slid the 6. And we've talked about how absurd Nikola Jokic has been. And now there are trade talks with Denver, which, I guess, very quickly on that front. Would you like Zach LaVine at Denver? I'll just toss you a quick free throw while we're just going through the standings.
Why would I not? I like Kentavious Caldwell-Pope in Denver. I like Michael Porter Jr. in Denver. I think I would like Zach LaVine in Denver.
So that's a fair logical conclusion.
I like Russell Westbrook in Denver. I think for Denver, it's the theory of making that deal would be, okay, let's have something else to re-elevate this formula. We got Jokic. You can have the opinions you would like on Jamal Murray. I imagine people have strong ones these days, but he's still a pretty good basketball player. And Jokic Murray is still not fun to guard. But if we have Jokic, we have Murray Jokic, we have Murray Jokic Gordon, and we also have that guy who can do other things, both with Jokic and maybe in the second unit.
That historically just bleeds points when Jokic is not there with them.
I mean, I think it's going to be very hard because of how good he is. You know, I think a lot of times the best players, the second unit is going to have a tough time because what we have is built around the best player. And you are not that. Mm-hmm. Like, I think sometimes we don't think about that enough. Like, yeah, this is our offense. And now it's center X doing it. With guard Y, yeah, we're going to take a break defensively and we feel confident defending this a little bit more. Well, that's my two cents. What do you think about the rumors rustling about Zach LaVine going to Denver?
They're intriguing to me. I think Zach LaVine would absolutely help this offense. I think he would be a hand-in-glove fit with Nikola Jokic. Like, taught very, first or second week of the season when I gave Zach LaVine a shout-out in the player section. With his cutting and just the general tempo, with Denver playing faster this year and like him getting to play off of Jokic, I would imagine that's going to be even more cuts in the half court specifically. And we know what LaVine can do with the ball in his hands. I think my only hesitation, like non-financial version, or non-financial slash non-health version, I do wonder how much the downgrade in size or just the general downsizing of that deal, what that would mean for Denver. Because they are like, they've had you. They'll sprinkle in Jokic in a drop, of course, but they do like having Jokic up at the level. And as inconsistent as MPJ has been as a backline guy throughout his career, he's been better as over the last couple of years versus, you know, when he started. Just having a 6'10 dude to make low man rotations and or help you in possessions, I think is just important to the defensive ecosystem for Denver. And if MPJ, because of the money, he would just have to be out of there. If you don't go to Zach LaVine, I think Zach LaVine is just better than Michael Porter Jr. But I do wonder, like, is he better enough in the areas that Denver needs him to be better to where it offsets what they're going to be losing with MPJ and the size and the rebounding? Because the defense is very important to head coach Michael Malone. I don't think, understandable because of the workload, but like, I don't think this has been like the best Jokic defensive season that he's had in the history of the pod. And so, like, I just wonder, like, what those adjustments would be like. Could they then get the defense to a level to where that works? And then you really feel the extra juice that LaVine provides offensively. You really feel that pop more because of that. If the offense gets better and the defense slides and they're still in the same spot, like, net rating-wise, obviously that's not how you make the argument. But just, you know, thinking through it right now. Like, what does that do for Denver? And then bringing the financials back in it, if it doesn't work to the degree that they want it to, what is the next pivot? Because bringing LaVine in, you are getting a little bit older with that. So it's not like you're going to get the same, let's turn LaVine into two $10 bills or something like that. Or at least I wouldn't think so in this climate and second apron and all that good stuff. So like, that's where I get a little bit hesitant.
I understand. But,
that's where I'm at. I'm curious to see. That was a big lacrosse with Tony Jones and Sam Amick of The Athletic. LaVine was the headliner in that article, but Jordan Poole was mentioned. Jordan Clarkson was mentioned. Like, they are very clearly on the market for, or in the market for, just more shot creation. And so if they can turn some of their other salary or a younger player that they aren't super invested in into, like, I guess I would probably prefer them go after, like, a Clarkson for less and keep MPJ, and you just hope MPJ continues to play well or, you know, turns up a little bit more. Jamal Murray is more consistently himself. And then you just get the extra second unit boost, et cetera, versus making the huge swing for LaVine. And now it becomes tougher to pivot if it doesn't work. But maybe that's just me being risk averse. So that's where I am at on that front. Steve, would you like to take this next question?
Sure. Next question comes from Matt. The Dallas Mavericks are a borderline top 10 defense, despite not always having the personnel to do so. They tend to be real steady and not have their share of ups and downs. How do you think they have gotten to this point in being this solid and sticky on the defensive end, and can it translate to the playoff level again like last year? Appreciate the pod and what y'all do. Nikias, what do you think?
Shout out the mod, Goose. But I think they've gotten there by... I mostly attribute it to like a collection of size 3 through 5 and just a general commitment to having their help in early. Like, I just think they do a really good job of shading help and shrinking the floor. Like, that's certainly what popped in the OKC series that we've referenced quite a bit over the past couple of weeks. But that's kind of been the bit. Like, I go back to, what was it, the 2021-22 season when they were surprisingly a top 10 defense. And I was like, I wrote an article about it when I got to do that. I was like, okay, let's dig in. Like, what exactly is this? Because this doesn't scream top 10 personnel. And it is just at the level sometimes, but we're in a drop. We just got help peeled in and we end possessions. Like, we're not a heavy force turnover team or anything like that. We're just going to be really principled. We're going to fight over screens hard. We're going to show early help. Going to try to prevent some rim attempts if we can. And we get out of there. And I think now, this year, they obviously have better personnel. I think P.J. Washington has been excellent defensively. Derek Lively, very good. Daniel Gafford, good at the rim, et cetera. They have even more rim protection. Do have some numbers on that front. But they have more rim protection. But it's still that same foundation of shrink the floor. We're going to make you make tough passes. And because we have the collective size that we do, if you do make these skips, we're able to close out and then ultimately funnel it back inside to these shot blockers and contesters. I just think they just make you work pretty much every possession, especially when they're all dialed in. So I think that on a basic level is where I'm at with Dallas. And I think they can absolutely continue to be that good. Like, we just saw it.
I'm calling revisionist history because you didn't like Dallas' defense. And I told you on this pod, they were pretty good defensively. And then you wrote the article. But I digress. I think for Dallas, they have a formula. And I think it was based on activity. Then they lost their way defensively. Couldn't get back to it. Didn't have the personnel. They now have the personnel as Nekiah State. So wing-wise, we have more people who can work to keep the ball in front. Luka has continued to try and work to get into the team concepts and slide the puppies on occasion. We feel more comfortable with what we're doing in pick and roll as far as, one, not having to rely on just being active, but having a level of versatility where we have the drop, we have rim protection. We can switch some of these bigs if we need to, and if we need to turn the activity button on, we can. That becomes a blend where we know what we're doing defensively, and there's a trust level, there's effort, there's multiple rotations, but there are moments where they don't have to be in rotation. So I think for Dallas, the tricky part is going to be, okay, how do we bottle that up? Because a lot of that OKC talk was help recover, close back out, help recover, just the base that they had. And so them being able to close out and fly around and dictate terms is what makes it fun. They have personnel who can guard top players. They figured out how to navigate some of the moments where Luka and Kyrie put in action. And it puts together a front where it's not just the easiest cookie to crumble every single night.
That's good stuff. I think on the number front, aside this early when we talked about Dallas, but Dallas flirted with top five in switch rate per clean the glass. They are switching more than they did last year with their centers in particular, as Steve stated. You're seeing more activity. Dallas centers in pick and roll switched about 14% of the time last year. That is up to 18.5% this year. And that's actually slightly lower than what it was when we talked about this earlier, but still a massive increase in terms of the switch rate there. Doing better against drives this year. Opponent blow-by rate has dropped basically 5 percentage points per second spectrum, so keeping the ball in front a little bit more. They do still load up their help. They are 11th in opponent rim rate this year as they were last year. Opponent rim field goal percentage, they are 7th this year and very sturdy in the half court this year as well. So top 10 mark there. So doing a really good job of just making life tough for you. And again, like that feels sustainable to me, especially if you get the buy-in from the stars. So I am certainly more of a Dallas believer than I was a few years ago on the defense front, to Steve's point. Next question going to come from Eeyore, who says, how many players on the Rockets do you think would deserve all defense consideration if the season ended today? Also, what do you think they do best relative to other elite defenses in the NBA? What makes them stand out?
I would probably go one in a possible. This feels like Dylan Brooks gets a lot of the credit. And then people move on. You gotta remember all defense is positionless, which is probably going to lean a very specific way. And if it doesn't, there is a pretty established layer of guards and wings that people tend to consider that could make it tough for entryway. So I'll leave it at Dylan Brooks. No disrespect. When it comes to what makes the Rockets defense good, I think it's just their base. I think this is a league where you've got to be able to sustain defense. You've got to be able to believe in yourself. You got to try and limit breakdowns, self-inflicted wounds as far as bad closeouts, as far as getting beat off the dribble, as far as overhelping or over-rotating. I think when they're humming, you don't see that from them. You see the shell. You see five red jerseys, for example, working in unison, defending on a string. I think they just stay solid. They pressure the ball. They're active off ball. They close out and work to keep the ball in front. Like, one of the things I love about Houston's defense when they're going is they meet you on the catch. Like, you do a handoff, you throw the ball, here's someone right there. Not even a full closeout, but hey, I'm here. They work to not overhelp. Like, we're going to show bodies, we'll show early help, but we're not going to overcommit if we don't have to. You know, the amount of times you see Shingun guarding his man in the dunker spot, someone drives. Yeah, I'm here in the lane, but I'm not putting myself in position where you have an easy play. Yeah, we're showing nail help, but, you know, you don't necessarily know if I'm going to commit or if I'm going to flow back to mine. Those little things are probably good. I think they have clean switches against off-ball movement. And they have that scheme versatility where we can put Shingun on a big. We can also put him on a non-shooting wing. We can scram switch Fred VanVleet out of things. They just give the effort when they're humming. So that's probably what separates, to me, is the base, the little things.
Okay. I like that. I like that. for all defense consideration for me, in typical Nekias fashion, it's like, okay, what would constitute as consideration for me? Like, actually has the top 10 argument, or is this like moderate to long list guy that you could put down? Like, how many people qualify for that?
Wait, before you go, so considering you gave that wide range and radius, and for the folks that don't know, maybe some new dunkers out there, Nekias typically has a list of 50 to 65 players that he will place on his all-defense team. And he will release it after releasing his actual all-defensive team. So stay on the lookout for that if you're on the sky, the blue, or whatever. So in my mind, I'm going to take a guess on the full consideration. I'm going to say he has 4 in mind.
Okay.
I'm going to leave it at that. Okay. We'll play a game. Make your guess now if you're listening, dunkers.
Unfortunately is probably too strong. Not 4. It was 3 for me. I wanted it to be 4. So you were still right. what dropped it to 3, however, is that because we have like the games played and like the minutes thing. And the minutes thing, the minutes thing tripped me up last year. Cause like, ooh, Nikhil Alexander Walker, he has a really strong case. Yada yada. Isaiah Hartenstein, really strong case. It's like, oh wait. Y'all played the games. Y'all ain't played the minutes. Oh, no. And so the person who I would probably give the most consideration to, just when I watch them on defense, they have been the best. It would probably be Tari Eason. Unfortunately, Tari's averaging like 21 minutes a game. And thus, I do not believe he's going to end up, unless they have like changed the requirements, and I'm just not aware, in terms on the minutes front. And being eligible, unless they've changed that, I don't think Tari's actually going to factor into all defense stuff, which is a shame because he's been tremendous. But Tari's the guy that I would want to champion here more than anyone. There are multiple candidates still, but I don't think he's going to qualify. So the 3 would be Dylan, as Steve has mentioned. Like, he's taken on the toughest assignments on the perimeter. He's done a really good job this year. Positive DEPM, if you care about that. Pick and roll numbers are good. Drive numbers are good, etc. Fred VanVleet continues to be pesky at the point of attack. Steve, you have mentioned the scram switches and stuff, the way he's been able to get out of there. Generally a good communicator, still in the Happer game. He is 3rd among 74 players in drive point possession allowed among the high volume group. He's 8th in pick and roll defense among a high volume group. So like, he at least has a threshold for consideration. Like, I don't think he would be in my top 10, but he's at least someone I would write down before whittling it down. And Amon Thompson would be the other guy that I would toss in, as he's at 27 minutes per game. So I think it's going to end up being close for him, unless, you know, there's an injury or if he just gets into the starting lineup. So the minutes per game thing, or the total minutes, might end up getting close by the end of the year. But I do think he's projected to qualify right now. And as such, a steal a game, a block per game, 6th in drive point per possession allowed so far, 12th in blow by rate among that same high volume group, 3rd in pick and roll defense, positive defensive EPM, if you care about that. And even when he's not like getting steals, just some of the on-ball reps that he's been able to put together and the assignments that he's taken on, he's been very good defensively this year. So like, those would probably be the 3 guys in earnest that I would at least put down on like a moderate to long list for Houston. And again, if Tari plays more, then Tari's just there because he's just been incredible. I want to make sure that this is not a matter of how good he's been, and it's just literally a minutes deal and me not being sure if he's actually going to qualify to be voted for. As far as what stands out compared to other defenses, like, Steve has nailed most of it. I think for me, it's the switching in general. And like, some of that is just the cross matching and things they can do on that front. But their ability to switch, you mentioned off ball, they do it well on the ball as well. And when they get to their smaller units, the rebounding can get shaky depending on who they're going small against, but ultimately they do a really good job of ending possessions anyway, because they force turnovers over 20% of the time in their lineups without a center on the floor, which it's a 20.1 opponent turnover rate in the minutes without a center on the floor for Houston per cleaning the glass. OKC leads the league at 19.1. To give you an idea of just how disruptive Houston is when they go small. And again, a lot of that is we have Tari and Amen on the floor together, and they just destroy worlds together. Tari Eason averaging nearly two steals a game in like 20 minutes. It's just stupid, complimentary. But I'll narrow it down there as, again, Steve has nailed it particularly, so I won't hang there too long. So any closing Houston thoughts before we head out of here?
Not at the moment. Mm-mm.
Okay. All right, next one going to come from Mo, who asked, on a Jover scale, which that made me chuckle when I saw it in the email, but on the Jover scale from 1 to 10, 1 being overreacting to 10 being truly Jover, where are we at with Scoot Henderson as a prospect or player?
I'm going to let you go first.
Okay. As I was trying to think about this, I guess I kind of oscillate between like a 4 and a 6. Like, I'm certainly not at 10. Like, I don't think he's a cult product or anything like that. And I think with any young guard, I just have, obviously they are different, very different players. But like, as a concept, I always have Darius Garland in my mind on this, where like the rookie season and some of the under the hood numbers and stuff were just really bad. And then it's like, oh, so he got experience, he got stronger. And now all these skills that we knew he had are popping, and now he's good. And then this year, he's all-star good, et cetera. And so I always have that in my head as well, like, if a guard starts out poorly or they're super inefficient, that isn't always an end game if they can generally get to their spots, if there are positive physical indicators, stuff like that. And so with Scoot, he has felt better inside the arc. Like, we talked about this on the pod. Steve recently did a full play breakdown from one of our watch parties. We were watching the Blazers game with Scoot. And some of the craft he's showing inside the arc. So, like, you're seeing some strides inside the arc. He has, in a literal sense, been more efficient inside the arc this year. And so you're seeing that patience. The athleticism is still there. Like, he has had some frisky point of attack possessions defensively. Like, I still worry about him off the ball a little bit. And if he isn't prepared to, like, get into someone's body to navigate something off ball, then the screen navigation can get kind of rough. Like, I think that's something that can get better. But, like, he does just need to shoot at a better level than he does. It doesn't even the three would obviously be nice, but like, if he gets more comfortable with pull-up twos, I feel better about him long term, because there's a world in which the three ball never comes, but because he can explode past guys and get to the rim, or because he's now, you know, altering speeds a little bit better than he did in his rookie year, he can get to some of the floaters where the footwork is a little bit better. Still a work in progress, but it's certainly better than what it was when we were talking about him on the rookie report and some of the wrong foot finishes and just weird timing on gaps and stuff like that. You are seeing it. And so my range is 4 to 6, and 6 being the high end is because, like, as he is still inefficient overall and things like that, I'm starting to lose a little bit of the Scoot can become like a star guard, but I'm certainly not out on him just being good. And I'm not even completely out of him developing into like an all-star talent. It is just getting a little hazier as he's made some strides, but they haven't been major strides that you can point to yet.
What's Scoot Henderson shooting on catch and shoot threes this year?
37.1% on 1.8 attempts.
It's a little bit better than last year.
Last year he was at a pristine, as this loads, 30.5% on 1.9 attempts.
Yeah, it's a little bit better. I think the Scoot question becomes, how do you evaluate him and what lens are you looking at? Are you just looking at the position he was drafted at? And now, well, I don't think he's ever become this. So, you know, if Scoot Henderson was the 28th pick in the draft, I'm not saying it's unfair. I'm just wondering, because I think that alters how you kind of view things. You know, do you view him as a second-year 20-year-old guard? Or do you view him as the number two pick face of the franchise future? It's going to change how you evaluate, you know, and that is up to you. I'm not an opinion changer. My thought on Scoot is, how much of the context has been great? Because I think there are some moments, to Nikias's point about the pull-up twos, he's felt better pace-wise at times, as far as I'm not hitting the turbo button all the time. Let me come off the screen. Let me see the drop. But now the footwork is leading you to a floater. Okay. Are you engaging the big? Are you being able to hit the roller? If they switch, is it just, hey, I got to get off the ball now, which is a good decision. But now how are you impacting it? how much of the context helps or hurts him. You know, it'd be, you know, does Scoot Henderson benefit and look better on a team that's better at defense to where now he gets to go in transition a little bit more than being in the half court? But there are unknowns that we don't know about. I think you kind of just track the progress of him in pick and roll, track the progress of the playmaking, track the progress of the defense. And, you know, is the ceiling lower? Probably, than when you first saw him. But I don't think that means it's closed. You know, there's still a roof that you can kind of move up and down like a car. Mm-hmm. So I'd probably say I'm like at a 3.
Okay, I think that's fair. Like, I think for me, like, just getting to some of these numbers, like, much better on shots between 10 and 16 feet this year, much better on shots from 16 feet up to the 3-point line. But then you get into the floater range stuff, as you mentioned. It was at 31% last year. It's at 23% right now. He's gotten better at the rim, but that number is still well below what you would want from a guard. And so, again, it's improvement, it's progress. I guess just getting to that next step is where I want to see Stu get to. And to your point, the roster context is interesting. Like, he's coming off the bench now. His literal rotation context has changed from last year on top of that. And so, I don't know. Just want to see a little bit more from Scoot. Like, it's probably too early to be like, I want him on a different team. But, like, as some of the guards and wings improve around him, like, I do wonder, does the floor become more spread? Like, I'm curious to see, like, I think Don McLingan absolutely is just the center. He's probably center now, honestly. But at the very least, he's center in the future. Like, how does that alter, like, what that potential partnership is going to look like long term? That's where I have a little bit of intrigue with Don McLingan taking threes. Like, I don't think we're multiple seasons away from, like, teams caring about him taking threes. But, like, if he can do some hub stuff, if he can knock down enough of those relief threes, like, does that open up handoff stuff for Scoot to get downhill and give him more avenues to improve in that area? I don't know. Like, there's a lot more that I want to see from him.
Yeah, I mean, I'm still in track to progress mode, so yeah. Okay. Sorry, Mo.
All good. Next question going to come from David, who asked, the year after Steph Curry retires, who's going to be the best shooter in the NBA?
Is Klay Thompson still playing?
When you do a podcast long enough, the literal first thing I have in my notes for this question, him, from a historical perspective, do we think Steph retires before Klay? So that's tremendous.
is the answer Nikola Jokic?
That would be that I didn't have in my notes. So hat tip to you.
Is it Peyton Pritchard? Like, here's the thing, real quick. I'm gonna go on a tangent very quickly. Has anyone looked at the 3-point percentage leaderboard recently?
I did this morning, and buddy, let me tell you.
Torian Prince leads the league at 51.6%. Nikola Jokic is second at 50. Isaac Okoro is third at 49.2. Karis LeVert is fourth at 48.8. Then it's Norm Powell at 48.5. Oh, it's Nikola Vucevic at 48%. Then it's AJ Green at 47.6. Then it's Kyrie Irving at 46.8. And hey, guess who's next? Royce O'Neal at 46.3. Then it's Karl-Anthony Towns at 46.1. DeAndre Hunter shooting 45.3. So is Andrew Wiggins. They are just behind Luke Kennard, who's shooting 46%. Hey, you know who's behind Andrew Wiggins and DeAndre Hunter? You guessed it. Dorian Finney-Smith at 45.2%. And then you know who's behind Dorian Finney-Smith? Ty Jerome, 44.7. Garrison Matthews, 44.6. Colin Sexton, famously known for shooting, 18th at 43.9. Tied with, also famously known for shooting, John Collins. And then we have Zach LaVine rounding out the top 20 at 43.5. Just eking out Nikhil Alexander Walker at 43.4, who's also tied with Amir Coffey. I don't know who's going to be the best shooter in the world. Some person we've never heard of. I'm not sure.
Oh, for clarity's sake, was that like the three-pointers made? That's three-pointers wait list, right?
I just went three-point percentage.
Oh, okay. But yeah, it's a very funny listen, like, I like to do the high volume filters, like who's doing what on like 7 attempts or 8 attempts or whatever the case may be. And like the names are just, it's that's a good testament to them. But it's also like, I didn't expect this.
You know, can we have this conversation real quick? Why are you hating on the low volume shooters?
I don't hate on the low volume
shooters. If I take three If I take two threes, I make one. I cooked. Why I gotta take eight more? I got my four threes. I made two of them. I did my job.
And that's important for you to do your job. Why, I just think.
Why am I getting yelled at for having a shorter route to success when it comes to three-point shooting? Why are we putting all this credit on the person who took 15 threes? I took 6.2. I made three of them. All right. Respect me.
I do respect you. And that is valuable for you to make those shots. I just think in general, there is like a volume slash efficiency threshold to reach to where teams are like, I got a hard close out on that guy.
No,
I can't leave this guy in help.
No, there's not. No, there's not. I'm going to counter back. Okay. We've seen players take volume threes and have a good percentage and teams be like, I still don't care. Mm-hmm. Hey, Grant Williams, no disrespect. You did what you were supposed to do. Didn't change how teams guarded you. It's all about the context. You know what I mean? Isaac Okoro making 1-3 and shooting two is probably more important for Cleveland than Ty Jerome taking more, in my opinion. There's a good chance Isaac Okoro is going to have to be on the court in the playoffs, and he's going to need to make a three. Mm-hmm. I don't think the volume is going to change the game plan unless we know you're a shooter. Like, does DeAndre Hunter now graduate to the phase where we got to close out on him, or are we going to get down to brass next time? And that's fine.
I think so. But I think in general, that's how you graduate to that portion. You take enough and make enough. The math changes on, okay, we have left this guy alone in the past. We can't really afford to do that. To the Grant Williams example, like, he has had good 3-point shooting seasons. Just looking at the attempts real quick. His best year is 3.4 attempts, about four the next year, 4.4, 4.5, that's the trade year. So 4.4 overall, he's at 4.6 this year. Like, I don't think that's enough. And I think defense to this point have still been like, okay, this is cool if we can help elsewhere. Like, I think if he's taking, just we'll make up a number in this case. But I think if he's making 37% of his threes, he's taking seven. We have a multi-year sample of that. I do think the math changes to, okay, he is a shooter. He's a willing shooter. He's not these down at a high enough clip, above league average, et cetera. Okay, we do have to think about this a little bit more than we normally would.
Until we don't, it's a choice. Hey, Malik Beasley, cool seven made threes a game. Nice 41%. I don't care. You're not one of these two guys. So have a blast. It's about when you make them. Mm-hmm. It's about when you make them, how many you make in the key moments. That's when your coverage changes. Hey, Steve Novak was a volume shooter, right?
Yeah, they figured out, oh, that man can't dribble at all. We don't care about that.
So congratulations on graduating to 3-point. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That's my 2 cents. That's my rant for the day.
Understood. I guess to answer the question, like, my initial thought, as I mentioned with the notes, like, hey, when is Klay retiring? And then conversely, like, hey, when is Kevin Durant retiring? Because if they all just go out the same year, one, that would just be kind of wild. But like, two, to the heart of the question, well, darn, who's left? I'll toss out a name for you because I had him down, especially when factoring in like what he's doing as a pull-up shooter this year, what he's done on catch and shoots historically, what he can do off movement. Where does Tyler Hero factor into this conversation in the post-Steph world? Because he's obviously going to be young enough to where, barring something catastrophic happening, like, he's going to be in the league when Steph retires. Does Hero get there?
My concern, maybe. I don't know if I go that far.
Okay. Because there's also the thing, like, as we talk about shooting, like, how much do you index the off the dribble stuff? Because obviously that's a higher degree of difficulty. And like, if you can just bust drop coverage with those shots, like, those shots may be more impactful, even if you aren't shooting as high a percentage as insert catch and shoot threat here. And so, like, back to the retirement angle, like, will James Harden be gone? when Steph leaves, as he has just made more threes than just about anyone except Steph at this point. And he will still just take and make a bunch off the dribble. Where does Luka factor into this? Is a thought bubble that I had. Because he takes so many off the bounce, like, I don't know if the percentages are always going to do him justice to, like, how good of a shooter he is. Like, Luka's an interesting name that I thought. Like, you mentioned Peyton Pritchard. I was like, well, darn, if he's just going to be 8 a game, 40-plus percent, and he's mixing in half-court makes, like, that part's the joke. But, like, there are going to be a lot of candidates for this, I feel like. Buddy Hield, if we're going back to the historical marker, like, he is just one of the best shooters ever, and I don't think he's going to retire before Steph Curry. So, is the answer honestly just Buddy Hield until further notice? That might just be my earnest answer.
It's not a bad shout.
So we shall see. I like that question, though. Made me think. This one going to come from Miles. Shout out Miles Ehrlich. It was a really good job covering the W at large, but really good work for the New York Liberty in particular. Who are y'all sleeper picks for the unrivaled 1v1 tourney?
Miles, salute for the question. Salute for all the work that you do. This is a rather easy question. Wildcard.
No shot.
I like my odds.
No freaking shot.
The odds are in my favor, are they not?
That's nasty work. The sleeper is player to be announced?
Yeah.
Do you know how loud you would yell at me if I did that literal bit?
Yeah, that's why I did it.
That's great.
That's why I did the bit. Now, here's the thing. I have a question. I have a very key question, right? Mm-hmm. So this one-on-one tournament, mm-hmm. Do we have any additional details that I have not seen?
See, that's the question that I had. I was like, is this just everyone that's already in the general player pool? Is there like a smaller pool from that player pool that's doing the 1v1 thing? Because that would also like curtail some of my options. So I just went from the general player pool for now.
Okay.
But I have four sleeper picks, and I can narrow down to one if you would like. But like, these are the four names that I thought about.
Wait a minute.
Outside of like the, what's up?
Wait a minute. No, continue. So you got mad at me for naming the wild card as a bit, but you have four sleepers.
Yeah.
All right, Bet. Sock it to me.
Okay. So in the, hey, you can't stay in front of me or I will put you underneath the basket. And you didn't think I would division. Natasha Cloud, strong driver, also can clamp you up, has all the experience in the world, just defending up two positions, sometimes three, because of what she had to do in Phoenix this past season. So Natasha Cloud, sleeper for me. Tiffany Hayes and the I will just continue to blow by you. And if it's make it, take it, you may not get the ball. It'd be a fun choice for me. Rekia Jackson, who is just going to be taller than a lot of the people that she will be playing against and can also just sprinkle in middies and post-ups and get to the basket, true bucket getter, et cetera. Final one's BG. Because who's making her miss? The silence is deafening.
I thought that was a rhetorical question.
And the ball goes out of bounds. But no, those would be the four names that I would think of, independent of getting more 1v1 information on who's actually doing the gosh darn thing.
So I'm assuming everyone's competing, as there is a cash prize. I just wonder, is it bigs against wings? Is it just randomly ordered? How's that work out? My sleeper picks, you know. I don't think, like, my mind goes to the defensive players who could just also hoop because you got to watch out for them in one-on-one play. So, like, the Dejanay Carringtons and Natasha Clouds of the world where, wait a minute, why'd you just hit four pull-ups in a row? What's happening? Is Marina considered a sleeper based on the competitions there?
Can be.
Also, like, the Brittany Sykes, like, there's elements there. Ultimately, I landed on Stephanie Dolson.
Stephanie Dolson is just going to be like the old like NBA live hack when you're doing the 1v1 game. I'm just going to shoot these threes. 2, 4, 6, 8, 10. Hey, 12, I win.
Hey, look, three threes and a post up.
And that's just it.
Throw it out there.
That's amazing. That is amazing. Next one going to come from William, who says, if you're Dan Padover, how do you handle the center position for the Atlanta Dream with Cheyenne Parker-Tyus and Tina Charles both being unrestricted free agents? The on-off ratings weren't kind to Cheyenne in 2024, and I think it's fair to say Tina's near the end of her playing career. What do you think?
I mean, honestly, you probably call Tina and ask, hey, you want to do one more year? I mean, it's a one-year contract type of year anyway, so why not?
That's true.
I don't think Cheyenne returns. No disrespect. The home run is probably picking up the phone, calling Bree Jones. Say, hey, how do you feel about Atlanta? Just kind of seeing if there's a conversation there. I mean, do you call Natasha Howard? Be like, hey, want to go play?
We small.
Hey, NECA. We got the wrong number? All right, my fault.
Darn.
But I think there's options for them. Or maybe you go lower down the list, get a free agent, draft, and hope for the best. Mm.
Well, this will not be a long question. As in my notes, I wouldn't bring Cheyenne back. Tina could, if the price is reasonable, if she's willing to come off the bench as a change of pace big, would generally want more athleticism in the room. Izzy Harrison is the only free agent name that intrigues me, plus has a level of realism. Bree Jones is obviously the best young big on the market, and I'm not sure if she's back in Connecticut, but we saw how teams tried to poke at her this postseason.
They no love for Bree Turner?
Well, hey, she is the most efficient player in the
the history-making Bree Turner?
Shout out Bree Turner in earnest.
Also,
that broadcast shout I can't get with, but go ahead.
Can we circle back? Why do you always want to put Tina Charles on the bench? Let her cook.
Yeah, with the second. Hey, listen. I think if Atlanta is actually going to play faster and we want to get threes up, et cetera, et cetera, I do generally just want more speed on the floor.
Okay, speed is fine, but who wants to play offense more than Tina Charles?
Not many. However, we also want to be able to get stops. I think if you want to get switchy, et cetera, or if you want to be aggressive defensively, like I think there are some better options than Tina, who, again, as I acknowledged throughout the season, like she held up better defensively than I anticipated heading into the year. Like, I still wouldn't call her like an elite one or anything like that. I think come off the bench, bully second units, can close if you're playing well. Like, I think that fits into, like, if it is going to be like her last year in the league. But I think that's fine. I don't feel like that's disrespect to Tina Charles. You know what I mean? This feels like an optimal role. Get your minutes, get your touches. We still get to establish our principles.
It feels like an optimal role that you've been trying to put Tina Charles in for the entire history of this podcast.
Oh, here's the thing, right? Other teams try to, is the, you know. But hey, it's okay. It's okay. But that's where I land with Atlanta center room. Next one going to come from, I'm going to say Meps. It's going to be very funny if it's just M. Epps and I just read it wrong. But either way, who would be your WNBA ethical all-stars? Defensive player of the year, vote receiver Courtney Williams is the first player that comes to mind.
So if I, for once in the history of the mailbag, have put a tiny rule in to see if it would make it more fun. So if you averaged more than 5 free throw attempts, I took you off the list. So salute to Asia Wilson, Arike Ngumbawale, Kalia Copper, and Jewel Lloyd. You're out of here. I imagine after the WNBA finals, Breanna Stewart's membership may be under review. So I will not mention that name. Tough. So here's the list that I came up with in no particular order outside of I was just scrolling. Nafisa Collier, Courtney Williams, Ryan Howard, Kennedy Carter, Kayla McBride, Jackie Young, Kelsey Mitchell, Alicia Gray, Ariel Atkins, Rakia Jackson, Benaja Laney Hamilton, Brittany Sykes, Bridget Carlton, Stephanie Dolson.
Okay. I love the Stephanie Dulcich show. Okay. So
I have some question marks at the end. Go ahead, Nakai.
Okay, that's fine. In Nakai's fashion, I too want to have some parameters. I did two separate parameters.
Of course.
So, okay. So the first one, so I have two like different like lineups, whatever. So like the first one, I was like, hey, you had to have taken at least 75 mid-range shots this past season to qualify for the list.
Jesus Christ.
What you mean? Okay. And so with that one, I have a roster of 8 right now.
How did you land on that in the ethical bucket getting? Are we reducing ethical bucket getting to solely pull-ups?
No, but like I do think you need it in the diet.
Okay. Look, give me your 8. I'm sorry.
So my 8. So the two backcourt players I have so far, we have Arike Ogunbowale and Kelsey Mitchell. In the front court, I also have Nafisa Collier. Mm-hmm. I do have Stewie. I do have Asia.
Okay.
Backcourt off the bench is Jewel Lloyd. Front court off the bench, Nneka Ogumike. Wild card is Courtney Williams. So like, that's my core 8.
Okay.
And so narrowed down again, I was like, hey, minimum of 75 mid-range attempts, no more than 75 above the break threes. Which would give me Courtney Williams, Kennedy Carter, Nneka still there, Asia still there. And then the three other bigs that qualify is Brittany Griner, Natasha Howard, and Tina Charles.
Okay.
And so, like, either one of them would do the job.
Hold on. Can I pause everything real quick? I have made a grain omission. Kelsey Plum, you're on this list. I don't care where the parameter is. All right. I almost made a boo-boo, all right?
Okay. Hey, that's fair. That is okay. Oh, but no, the free throw shout is a good one. Because I forgot. I feel like we did that when we did, like, the ethical 2K thing. Yeah. We did a free throw limit. So, like, we're an hour and 20 minutes into the pod. So maybe I'll come back next week and drop that at the end of the next episode. But I do now want to make a team with free throw parameters as well. I think that's a good shout.
Okay,
that
so
is oversight on my part.
So here's the deal. These are players that had less than 5 free throws, but I wonder if the public would have some question marks. Okay. Where does the old Caitlin Clark land on this here list? Because in my mind, a bucket. A mostly ethical bucket. And occasionally...
Now, what's ethical about a 36 foot?
So, you know, dry finish, you know, she was in consideration.
Okay.
Secondarily, where does Sabrina land on this list? Because I had her number 1. And then again, after the 2024 WNBA finals, I reconsidered stating that out loud.
Which, hey, to her credit, she was playing with the finger injury that she ended up getting surgery on. I want to add that is a very quick injury note. So a little bit of bail, but I understand where you're coming from.
Jonquel Jones. Diana Taurasi.
Okay.
Because yes, but also. Then DT should make the list. And then I had Marina Mabry.
Mm-hmm.
And then I remember
Marina earlier.
Well, no, every single commentary team has said something unethical about Marina. So I left it there.
Okay. Oh, that's neat. That's neat. I like that.
So fun question. Cool. Are we ready to go to the most dangerous, despicable, deplorable question in dunker spot mailbag history?
Yes. Our final question coming from our dear Teej, who says, hi, hello, shing shing, if you will, to the wonderful folks of the dunker spot.
Shout out Carmen Petrovich. Anyways.
We watch so much wrestling during dunker spot watch parties. All-star voting starts tomorrow, which you can tell when that question was sent in. And I had the random thought that mid players get no love and thus a question was born. Who would be on your poverty all-star ballot? Y'all can set the rest of the parameters, but the one I will set is that they must average less than 15 points per game. I hope you have some fun with this one. And in a secondary email, she did say your gnaw star ballot, one might say.
Gnaw star ballot is kind of funny. So I'm going to ask very quickly. Actually, I'm going to say, for one, Andrew Wiggins and AC Green were voted in as All-Stars. That happened in my lifetime. So, you know, starting out there.
Boy, no, let me
literally, we had a battle on this very podcast by Andrew Wiggins.
He still shouldn't have, but it's okay.
No, I'm going to ask you a question, guys. A very crucial question. Mm-hmm. How many people did you select? And did you add any additional parameters?
Well, Steve, I have a full 12. And the parameter that I added was no prior All-Star appearances.
Oh, God. Because, what kind of list? Because it would be, I mean, it'd just
be
have.
Very easy to hack like Draymond, and, like, which he's not mid, but you get what I'm saying. So I was like, okay, let me at least add the All-Star qualifier to like signify role player. Also, I guess the bar for mid for me is also just a lot higher because, like, I guess mid does just have like a negative connotation. I do think there's a subset under All-Star that is still good. And so, like, that's what I aim for more than, like, let me find the 74 overalls, which I could do in a separate exercise, but, like, I aim, like, sub All-Star division.
Please don't. This was difficult enough. Please don't. I also have a full 12. So I went to NBA.com because All-Star voting is open. So you can use the app or go to NBA.com to vote for the All-Star game in the new All-Star tournament format featuring four distinct and different teams in the Rising Stars in a spectacular event that will feature two games with target points, a semifinal and then a final, and champion will be crowned in this exciting new event. Hashtag ad. And so I went there, sorted by points, because everyone's there. I didn't want to look at just points per game. I wanted to visually see it. And this is what I came up with. So I guess we'll just go West starting lineup, then you give yours?
Yeah.
In the West, I have Desmond Mayne and Klay Thompson in the backcourt. And I did this, I went to NBA.com to do the voting so I could see who they classified as who, and there would be no debate. In the front court. I went PJ Washington, Aaron Gordon, and Isaiah Hartenstein. Where were you at, guys?
Okay. Oh, so did you do? Oh, you did East and West.
Yeah.
Like that's fire. Yeah, oh.
Like an All-Star game is.
Ah, see, I just did like a 12. Darn.
Oh, well, then I have to go on my own then. Because I have 24.
I will say, I have a lot more West players than East players, so I guess it would effectively be like the West All-Stars for mine. But darn, I could have had like a full, I could have did 24.
I know, I thought you were going to, which is why I did it.
Oh,
this is the group project where the person who usually does all the work didn't do it, but the person who doesn't usually do that stuff actually did it. No, I got the PowerPoint right here, big dog.
See, this is like the very rare downside of like, hey, here's the doc. Dude, we don't pre-plan our answers or anything like that. It's pretty much like, this, just so you know who I'm talking about, but like, I'm not telling you what I'm going to say, yada, 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 yada. So, and this is what can happen. If we are not in mental lockstep,
You know what? I'll reveal all mine then. And then you can reveal the Nekias top 12.
Okay.
Nas of the world. off the bench for the West, Russell Westbrook and Amen Thompson in the backcourt. In the front court, Dylan Brooks, Lou Dort, and Derek Lively. And my two wild cards are Chris Paul and Walker Kessler, who is very, very high in blocks per game and rebounds per game in a way that I did not notice until this morning. Tari Eason was under consideration. Tyus Jones was under consideration. But, I mean, Chris Paul is like, what, 6 in assists per game? Had a thought about D'Angelo Russell, Stephon Castle, Buddy Hield. Christian Brown makes this list. If it wasn't specifically sub 15, he's currently averaging 15, so I removed him. Zubac is also above the threshold. In the East, the backcourt, Dyson Daniels and Josh Hart. And this is where the East got massively underratedly disgusting. The front court, Jared Allen, Brooke Lopez, and Mo Wagner.
Okay.
Go ahead, folks. If you have the app, go to the voting, go to front court, sort by points, go to sub 15, and then tell me what you see and tell me how much fun you would have. In the backcourt, also easy, Drew Holiday, Ayo Dosunmu. in the front court. Obi Toppin, Clint Capella, and Bobby Portis. And now let me tell you where this got disgusting. Visually, if you open that up and you scroll and you look at the name sub 15, and this is no disrespect to anyone involved, I didn't know who to pick. I'm sitting here having a debate between Bobby Portis and Tobias Harris on a Friday morning. It's not how I anticipated enjoying my strawberries before the pot. I'm trying to figure out Kelly Oubre. Does Kelly Oubre have a case? Hey, Onyeka Okongwu. I mean, he's coming along. Jonas Valanciunas, oh, hasn't played enough games. Kevin Love's in pet. Shouldn't be doing that on a Friday. Should be finishing up some shopping, having a good day. Instead, I had to do this. Miles Turner was right at 15. Would have made my day a whole lot easier, but unfortunately. And my two wild cards, Caris LeVert and TJ McConnell were my two wild cards. Under consideration, Ochai Agbaji, Ty Jerome, I had a brief thought about, Andrew Nimhard, Anthony Black was in consideration, Okoro, 0.2 seconds thought about Ben Simmons, Trey Mann also had a thought. But yeah, those are my East and West all-stars.
That's so fire. Look at Steve going through the, oh man, that's fire. I feel bad now.
Why do you feel bad?
I got more work to do.
Also, I do this all the time. I just usually be clearing out for you because you do the thing. And so we don't need both of us doing 80 people. Nobody wants to hear that.
Tough. All right. Well, my under 15 point per game / no prior all-star appearances team, which thank you for having Chris Paul. You know what I mean? So, somebody had to do it. But in the backcourt, Amen Thompson, Dyson Daniels. In the front court, Tari Eason, PJ Washington, Aaron Gordon for me. The reserve backcourt, I have Caris LeVert and Josh Hart, which I just had to edit my notes because I had Josh Hart as a front court piece. But if he's actually getting backcourt votes, one, I'm going to yell at the league, but two, then fine. Let me reconfigure the wild card spots. It was fine, but I got the same seven, but had to do some reconfiguring there. In the front court, we have Derek Lively, we have Lou Dort, we have Santi Aldama, and my wild cards, Ayo Dosunmu. And we can't have the all-star ballot without having Nikhil Alexander Walker. So he gets my last wild card spot, as he has shot well from three this year. He's just giving Minnesota some important relief buckets for a team that has not been that good offensively overall. And the defense remains very good. And so that would be my 12.
Very good. I like it.
How about that? Okay, well, before we get out of here, Steve, any closing thoughts? Players to shout, questions?
Brother.
Anything of the sort?
Brother, I got free throws.
Oh, all right, well, fair enough.
I know this is a foreign concept to you, but I got them.
Okay. You see, I'm an ethical podcaster, so I can't take free throws.
I you know what? I should have let the silence just sit.
No pop. That's tough.
No, not a singular one. A stronger rookie of the year case, Jalen Wells or Eves Missy?
I'm going to go Eve Missy.
Stronger rookie of the year case, Jalen Wells or Dalton Kennett?
That's probably going to be Jalen Wells for me.
Stronger rookie of the year case, Tristan Da Silva or Jalen Wells?
Jalen Wells.
Stronger rookie either case, Stephon Castle or Eves Missy?
This is a nasty little bracket you got going on here. Here's my problem with this and with the Stephon Castle rookie of the year case in general. As you know, I am a big Stephon Castle fan. Huskies, etc. He has been important for them. He has made many a big play. He's been good defensively. Have you seen what he shot this year?
What you got, big dog?
Oh, Lord.
We're looking at 37, 26, 73 splits. Is that what we're talking about?
It's kind of He's got a, it's a sub 48 true shooting this year, which is kind of tough.
Okay.
But like, it can't be, but he has still just been like, he's closed games for them. Like he's made, like it's tough. And Eve Missy has just been, he's just been good.
I presented the bracket to you.
I know. I just, it's just like, darn, you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, man.
You know, we'll go Eve Missy. Like, New Orleans has to have something. I'm sorry. Hey, man.
You efficiently pilled monstrosity.
Monstrosity is crazy. Come on, man.
Oh, my God. 9-9
with a block. Like, he's starting already. Like, come on.
Stephon Castle has started games as well.
I know, but it's, hey.
See, this is not growth. This is not growth. This is not growth. That man said, you're doing good, but you can't shoot. So, hey, who's that big guy over there? Oh, my goodness, brother.
Oh,
I can't
man.
Wait like, for the Sixth Man of the Year campaign that you mysteriously come up with. I don't know who it's going to be, but it's going to make me mad. Not that much. Nikias,
what's up?
This is not according to any sort of glass cleaning. Can you name the five teams in the NBA who are top 10 in offensive rating and defensive rating?
Hey, Steve, you want to be mad at me real quick?
Sure.
As I also get mad at myself. So in my notes, as I was prepping for the contender question, I naturally had in my notes the teams that are top 10 in offensive and defensive rating, not just for this year. But for the past five seasons, to build out the list. So the earnest answer is that yes, I do know who the five teams are. I can still answer if you would like, because these are clean the glass numbers. So there may be a little bit of difference. I could end up being wrong still.
Yeah, let's. So you mean to tell me, okay, just what are the five?
We got the Thunder, the Cavs, the Celtics, the Mavericks, who are in, I think, 10th defensively, and the Memphis Grizzlies, who continue so to here, be
the... Here's the shift, and this is where we get a Nikias type of twist. Okay. Non-cleaning glass version, the Dallas Mavericks have fallen to 11.
Yeah, see, that'll
do. Which means your five are the Cleveland Cavaliers, the Boston Celtics, the Memphis Grizzlies, the Oklahoma City Thunder, and the Miami Heat.
The Miami Heat, who are 9th in offense and 11th in defense for cleaning the glass, funny enough. So,
all point differentials matter. What's more surprising, Nikias? Miami being 10th in offensive rating or the Philadelphia 76ers being 12th in defensive rating?
Oh, Lord, man. Honestly, a near top 10 defense with Embiid missing that much time is kind of wild for Philly. I'd probably go with that one.
Okay. Very good. You know, that's all I had. Okay. I'm just gonna hit the horns.
It's since I'm back in my notes that I did not hit on during the mailbag. A quick shout out to Mike Vorkunov of The Athletic, who posted on Blue Sky that the Thunder, the Cavs, and the Celtics all have a winning percentage of 80 or better. After 25 games, there have only been 7 other seasons when 3 teams simultaneously had an 80 win percentage or better after 25 games. Each time, one of the teams won the title. The years were 1972, 1993, 1996, 2004, 2008, 2010, and 2013. So this is a thing that has not happened in over a decade. Shout out to the Thunder, the Cavs, and the Celtics, who are, again, on the top 10 in offense and defense list. So there you have it. There you have it. And with that, thank you for listening to this episode of The Dunker Spot. If you haven't already, please subscribe. We are on Apple, Spotify, RIP Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcasts. You can find us. And every Tuesday, the day after Monday, the day before Wednesday, we are on the Young Man of the Three YouTube channel, formerly the JJ Reddy YouTube channel. So if you want to get the visual element, some plays spliced in, live Steve reactions when I say something ridiculous, you can see that every Tuesday on the YouTube. So check that out. You can follow me on Blue Sky at Nikias NBA. You are not allowed to follow Steve. So I'm sure you can find him if you look hard enough. Just don't tell him. Join us for our online Dunker Spot watch parties. The link is in the podcast description. Click on that link, create your profile. It is free to do so. No shenanigans. If you have a League Pass subscription, you can watch games alongside us. We have the random, hey, that play looked cool, let's talk through it segments in there. Beyond that, we get random video game things happening. We do have a Dunker Dynasty happening on College Football 25. So we have some games streamed in there sometimes. Naturally, we'll watch a little bit of wrestling on, Jesus, it's wrestling in some capacity just about every day at this point. But we'll go through random YouTube rabbit holes, listen to music. TikToks are getting sprinkled back into the watch parties, much to my chagrin. But we have a lot of fun. So if you want to have some fun with some cool people, watch some hoops, talk some hoops in a healthy manner, and generally just have a good time, come join us for our online Dunker Spot watch parties. And with that, we will catch y'all next week.
Bye.